I would say 9 times out of 10, the lady would have enchiladas or a burrito of some type. So, Michael, do you know what I'm doing this coming up weekend? I'm just busting to talk to somebody about it. Because I have a wonderful wife and she totally understands why I need to take these random little kind of solo trips to do things every now and again. And this coming weekend, not obviously today, but this coming weekend, Saturday, Sunday, I'm going to the Retro Revival event in Wolverhampton, which is just outside of Birmingham. And it's a testament, Michael, to how crazy I'm getting into these retro arcade machines. It's basically, it happens once a year, it's called Revival, and it's got a site that's got all the details, and there's forums. I've been digging into arcade forums, and they're all converging. Most of the UK, who is into the retro arcade collection, gaming, repairing, discussing world, are all converging on Wolverhampton. So I'm going there next Saturday and Sunday because I have to be a part of it.
So is this a conference where people are playing games or talking about games or what's happening?
That's a good question. They've just released the floor plan. And what I can tell you is there's at least 4 rooms chock full of retro or of the actual vintage arcade machines. So we're talking 1980s to mid 80s, the Pac-Mans and the Donkey Kongs and Xevious and all that, Zaxxon, those kind of games. There's going to be plenty of those. There's speeches that are going on, and everyone in the forums is really excited because the Saturday talks will include, I'm just going to the site now because I don't know his name by heart, but he is the guy that wrote or designed Doom. His name is, he's an American. John Romero, that's who it is.
Yeah,
John Romero.
So he's going to be there. Like, you know, selling JAMA boards out of their car boots in the
Yes, they are, Michael.
Lot.
Yes. And embarrassingly, I made myself a shopping list. I need a couple of JAMA boards. I need a JAMA loom. I need a JAMA harness. I could use some leaf switches and buttons. I'm all in on the retro gaming thing, at least at the moment. This is my hobby at the moment.
Okay, so rewind, 15, 20 years. What, all right, Eddie growing up in Dallas, Texas, let's say you were maybe 13 years old in 1986 or so?
Yeah, that's right, 86. I'd say 84 to 85 were my big arcade years, I think. So I was thinking about this recently.
Yeah, so what kind of place were you going to? Like, was there arcade there near your house? Who were you hanging out with? What was it like?
Yeah, so there was this arcade, and I used to ride my bike, and I'd have to cross the highway. I remember having to walk it across the highway to go to this place called Aladdin's Castle. And I think it was a national chain. So it was kind of just like these dark, you know, dank, terrible carpet with dark purple carpet with confetti, fake confetti colors all along the floor and neon lighting that was burning out and flickering and all kinds of machines that had dirt and grime and scratch marks all over them. But I would go there in the summer pretty much every day with this little sack of tokens because they accepted tokens and would just play my head off. Things like Defender was always my favorite, and Tron. And then I got into the Top Gun thing around 85. So any games that had anything to do with like shooters and aircraft shooting things, I was well into.
What happened? Do you remember the day when Dragon's Lair showed up?
I do. It's so funny you mentioned that. I do. I was at a movie cinema theater, like one of those big multiplexes in Dallas. And on the way in, they had a little arcade on the side. And they had just gotten Dragon's Lair. And there was a huge crowd around it. And they had an extra monitor set up on the top of the machine so that the crowd could all watch the play of the person below. And it was... Yeah, it was crazy. It's funny that it was, you know, that's a moment I remember.
So have you seen the Donkey Kong documentary?
I have, The King of Kong, about Steve Wiebe and Billy Mitchell.
Yeah,
that's an interesting one.
It's weird. I wonder if there's an age difference between us, or if I was, I mean, I know there's an age difference between us, but I just never, as entranced as I was by video games, I never got hooked by them. And it may have been that I didn't have a place that I could ride my bike to, and, or that I just started riding my bike and kept riding rather than.
Right. I mean, were there video games at like 7-Eleven or Stop and Goes or any of those kind of places that
you
go to?
You know what? You know how some people have just like innate things about their physical presence that they carry with them their whole lives? And maybe I always felt a little weirded out by touching this joystick that other people had sweated and spread SARS over. And like, it's always weirded me out. Like things that you can sense a history of physical presence of other people.
And yes, like a well-worn doorknob, I suppose.
Yeah, there's total beauty in that, but maybe that's what kept, I have no idea. Maybe I didn't have enough quarters.
See, that's funny
I don't know.
To me. Because I would have pegged you as potentially being well into video games, you know.
And, I should have been. That's the thing. I wasted time. Yeah, I didn't. I think it was sports. I was just so full sports that I didn't think about playing something else. I mean, I did at other people's houses, but I never developed an addiction. My favorite game was Galaga. It was like the easiest game
to
play.
Galaga.
You know, it didn't require.
Yeah, no, it's got some challenges.
Didn't require anything special. It's just, you know, easy. I didn't like learning the rules, and I couldn't get into the adventure of it. You know, the like, oh, well, you get up to this next level, and then all this other stuff happens. It never took me. But
which is precisely why I can't get into modern games at all. And maybe there's something about those early 80s kind of fast twitch, you know, kind of crazy games where it's all about reactions and just kind of, you know, you don't think about anything else when you're playing those early 80s games. They're really cool in that way, like Galaga or Donkey Kong. You're just in the moment. Whereas the new ones where, you know, it's 3D and you got to go, you're a mage or something, and you got to go collect, you know, gold to go buy chainmail and all that crap. I could care less about that stuff.
So, okay, tell me this. How many times did you play Angry Birds?
A couple. I was never into Angry Birds. I don't like gaming on the phone.
You couldn't get could you get the thing to really fly at all?
Yeah, you know, I got him to snap back and fly a bit, but I just found it a bit annoying. It didn't capture anything for me.
Mine would fly like 20 feet and just die and die and die. And I was like, I don't want to spend the time and attention it takes to get this thing to fly through these, you know, gates or whatever. You really have to care.
Yeah, you do. And you know what's funny is that more and more things like the new Xbox, Xbox One and PS4 and all that stuff is really being targeted to adults more than kids. You know, and I have a lot of people I know that have Xboxes and PS4s and grown men in their 40s who play, you know, every night or, you know, at least a couple times a week. Thank God I'm limited to a big physical arcade machine that's in our office.
That's so great.
And I can't be caught playing it too much. So that's not good. So that keeps me sane.
I guess what you get right now, if you were to become a kind of adult gamer, is you get the internet connection ability. You get the fact that you can play with people all over the world, like this guy, like Kevin Spacey's character on House of Cards or something. But that's a total win, and the graphics are better. But I like this turn toward these vintage games. I think that I love that there's something there, right? Technology advanced, not because we needed it to advance, but because it's always advancing and that's what it does. But maybe nobody has made the perfect small processor vintage old school game. Like maybe nobody made it yet, and like it's still there. Like somebody could still develop it.
Yeah, well, that's why things like even Angry Birds, that's probably even more complex, but like Flappy Bird and those kind of games, they're just simple and people really like that.
Yeah, right. Once you pare it down to the kind of essential, I like what you're saying about twitchy. The twitch response, reaction time, that there's something there still, that we still will always kind of love that.
Well, it's the, you know, these new, I guess they call them, what do they call the massive online, you know, where you take on a character and all that stuff, MMRG or MMPG, whatever they call that. I used to work, it's just terribly stereotypical, but I used to work at a software company whose head developer, obviously a geeky type guy, was apparently well renowned in World of Warcraft circles. He led a certain guild successfully for years and was very good at what he did, to the point that he claimed that it improved his CV so that certain hiring managers would look for people who were successful, particularly successful in certain ways in World of Warcraft. And, you know, I still think it's so funny. I just wonder what the ads for these jobs are reading. You know, we're looking for a fifth level fire mage who's good with elf attacks. I mean, well, what are they hiring for?
Right. They're hiring a real person for the real world who's shown aptitude in a virtual world trying to be real. You know what excites me about the whole video game thing, just the futureness of it, is what's happening in South Korea. It's probably happening elsewhere in Asia, but I'm not sure. The televised nature and sporting arena nature of video game kind of combat. So 20,000 people will show up at an arena to watch two guys play a video game. That's insane.
I've never heard of that.
And it's becoming something that's televised, yeah, where you can kind of tune in, like Monday Night Football, and watch a couple guys play StarCraft. Have you heard?
No,
is that familiar
no.
to you?
There's got
to
be YouTube videos or something of that, right?
Yeah, and it's a huge YouTube thing as well. Like, and YouTube's kind of enabling it. You know, it's moving forward faster because of YouTube. So there's entire channels that are just dedicated to just broadcasting kind of the best players in the world at particular games battling each other.
Wow. So it's kind of a sporting type of thing. That's interesting.
What was that dumb show in the 90s where it was American Gladiators,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
Where they were battling with huge Q-tips.
Yeah, the pugil sticks. That's right. They were on those. I just remember it because I remember, I think I was 16, and I could just stay over my girlfriend's house until the end of that show. So I actually was always hoping it would last longer. There'd be a few more pugilist battles.
So you were allowed to stay at your girlfriend's house
until the end of American Gladiators, because that came on, I think, at 10:30 and ended at 11, and her father would kick me out after that show. And so would
her dad watch it with you?
No. Thank God we had some privacy in that case.
That is lovely.
But that was it. And I just remember hoping that those Q-tips would stay intact and those people would keep fighting.
The thing that I like in stories about kind of young love, this is what, sixth or seventh grade or something?
No, I was 16, so I was in high school. I wasn't that dumb. I was passing the years, okay.
The thing that I like are the intersection of young teen romance with media and what it happens to be. So for you, it was American Gladiators until 11 o'clock and getting kicked out. Like that, there's something real kind of quaint and innocent about that. I remember, I remember going on a date with a girl, maybe in eighth or ninth grade, and we went to see American Tail.
What's that? I don't remember that.
It's just this animated movie about a mouse.
With the rat. Yeah, I do. I remember that. You took her on a date to see American Tail.
Well, she wanted to see
that
it.
That was cute.
She got to pick.
That's good.
And the choices that you're making are just not the best choices at that point. You don't really care about what you're sitting there watching as long as you're sitting next to this person on the couch.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll do.
Or sharing popcorn.
Yeah, I never got into taking girlfriends to films. I don't know why. I think, yeah, it was never something we did. I would take them to dinner. I would like to take them out to eat. So that was always a big thing. And in Dallas, Dallas in the 80s, it was a challenge to find, you know, restaurants that would kind of cater to 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, and people would be chuckling. And, oh, it's terrible.
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
Would you order for her?
If she asks. So if it's a type of place, and in certain Texan restaurants, you know, there's several steaks on the menu per se, and I would say the lady will have. And yeah, I did that a couple of times. On homecoming, I'm sure I did that. She was busy with her corsage.
So is this like an Olive Garden style place
Yeah,
or?
usually chains, Tex-Mex on occasion. Tex-Mex was a big thing when I was 16, 17, 18. That's kind of what the kids ate. We all ate Tex-Mex. So yeah, it would have, I would say 9 times out of 10, the lady would have enchiladas or a burrito of some type.
Right. And it was like my dinner with Andre style conversation
Oh,
between the two of you.
identical to that film. That's why when I saw it, I just found it so spooky. We were talking about, you know, how to be real and you know, the different facades we wear, the same type of conversation.
Well, I love that, you know, we both have daughters. Yours is 3 or approaching 3.
Yeah, almost 3.
And ours is kind of 2.5. And even at this stage, there are levels in which they are both trying to play adults, you know? Like every very small ways. And that just keeps increasing and keeps changing over time, right up through being a teenager, where when her dad was taking other teenage girls out for dinner. Gosh,
Yeah,
that's
that's what
so
worries
great.
me. That does worry me, that phase. And you're right, my daughter's doing that kind of thing. She's making us get in bed, and she sits at a chair next to the bed, attempting to read us a story. So we just can't seem to get the reverse happening, unfortunately.
That's fantastic. I've just realized that we have like another being in the house who wants to be part of the team, like the
Right.
team. Let's say, you know, the team Our House, which is a place in which all these things have to happen. And hey, can you run and get that? Or can you take these over here and put them there? And she's just ready to go. And she'll come back and get a high five. And I don't know if I'm kind of sportsifying domestic life, but it's great to have somebody coming off the bench to pitch in.
Absolutely. The extra little hands, you know, are actually quite helpful. I find she can reach things I can't reach under the bed and that kind of stuff. It's great.
They really dig deep for stuff. They're motivated to really get in the smallest nook and crannies to get the golf ball that's rolling under, you know, the bureau or.
Yeah. In our case, it's that annoying. Do you have an Apple TV? Have you ever seen those controllers? They're built to slide between cushions and couches. They don't stay above surface for more than a good 10, 15 minutes.
Okay, so how many remotes do you currently have in your family room?
I've simplified things. We've got two, one for the TV, one for the Apple TV, and that's it. It used to be
That's
crazy.
beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so okay, so the Apple TV one still gets lost because it's tiny. I know those little white ones are tiny, right?
Yeah. At least the
It's
white
like
ones
an.
were plastic. It's those chrome ones that are, they rub them down with surf wax or something. They're so slippery and they slide everywhere.
They got some Mr. Zogs on there.
Exactly. So, how many do you have?
We've got too many, but my idea, and I'm always threatening to do this and still have not, but should, is just get a huge piece of plywood, like a splinter causing, you know, just a rough piece of wood, and just slap, you know, 4 or 5 strips of fuzzy backed Velcro on there and just put the Velcro on the remotes. And then you've got like a Starship Enterprise style control panel for the whole thing. And that thing's not getting lost.
I like the fact that it would be just kind of a big, nasty piece of wood. That's very DIY of you. That's great. So you wouldn't even sand it. Nothing like that. Just kind of put a couple
No.
of nails in it.
Well, right. So that's my idea, is to make this thing really cumbersome and horrible. But you know, there are many variations therein in which you could make it smaller and more customized and easy to handle. And it could be stained. You could wood burn your family's crest on it. I mean,
Exactly. That would be
there are a
good.
lot of options. So that still might happen. I'm threatening.
Well, you know what this leads to is a very brief discussion about Android. Because you see, I have an Android phone now, and most Android, kind of the flagship phones, the Samsungs and the HTCs, they have, because they just want to do everything, they try to do too much. But admittingly, this is great. They've all got an IR blaster in them. So most of the controlling I do comes out of my phone. So I just download apps that let me do universal remote stuff. So it's in my phone, which is kind of nice.
That with the iPhone that works too, and anything that's attached to Wi-Fi, there are universal remotes as well. Yeah. The last thing I want to be doing when looking at a screen is holding my phone and using the less time I've got my phone in my hand, the happier I am.
I've got a solution to that now. I've got a new smartwatch.
Oh, jeez.
It's Android Wear, but I'm telling you.
You've been threatening. We've had three episodes. You've been threatening for the last three episodes. I'm excited to hear the watch has landed. What is it about?
So
how is
Android
it?
Android Wear is hands down the best smartwatch that I've got. Now, I've got the Pebble. I've had the Pebble. I've had the Meta Watch, which was horrible. God, it was just horrible. I had the Samsung Gear 2, and Samsung Gear Fit. This is the Samsung Gear Live, and they finally got it right. And that's because the software is Android Wear, and it means, you know, Google Now, those little cards that come up in the iOS app, or on sometimes there's notifications on Chrome that'll pop up. So it's basically a conduit for Google Now, so it tells me things that I need to know, but I can talk to it as well. That's where it gets super cool. I could say, okay, Google, what is the height of the Eiffel Tower? Which, you know, any good pub quiz is going to ask. I could say, okay, Google, call my wife, send my wife a text, send my friend an email.
You can do all that with your phone too.
Yeah, but I got to take it out of my pocket, unlock it, and then activate Google.
The watch is kind of an interface leaper. Like, it allows your phone's interface to leap out of your pocket and become visible and more interactive and closer to your face.
Embarrassingly, on the weekends I'll be wearing this, but I'll have my phone charging or just upstairs plugged in, and the Bluetooth connects it throughout the whole house well enough that I kind of was feeling I was being a bad dad for a while, you know, checking my phone all the time, and had this guilt thing about it. Now I just get a vibration if there's something, and I can set the level of importance of the mails that'll vibrate. So if there's like a work specific mail from a client, it'll vibrate, but on the weekends, nothing else will vibrate. So it's kind of liberating in an odd way. It's been kind of liberating.
So what you're talking about and what you're describing is opening up this whole new level of thought about mobile apps and how humans are interfacing with them, in that the kind of next level to get to is not necessarily about apps. It's about the perfection of the notification. Does that sound correct?
Yes, and it's about control. So I can say something's notify me or bug me about this, but not about that. Because for a long time, notifications or push notifications or alerts or whatever you call them, you would just get flooded with, you know, an update's available, or have you checked out this new feature, just all this crap, the spam notifications. And now, at least with Android Wear, you can be really specific, maybe not as specific as I'd like it to be yet, but it's the best instance of identifying just the things I want to be bugged by and limiting it to that. So you can control what apps can alert you. And when it comes to mail in particular, like Gmail, I can control what types of messages alert me. So it's getting better. It's getting there.
So it's almost like going through Facebook and setting your privacy and visibility and all of that, but for your entire life.
Yes. Well, or for your digital space. So I guess the mobile is the best. Your phone is the best description of that, because you kind of centralize all your stuff there. So yeah, it's a way of just filtering it a bit, because it's really difficult to filter right now. And I used to, before the watch, just, you know, unlock my phone and check the home screen for alerts, you know, like 10 times an hour, maybe more. Now I don't have to. So we'll see.
So Wired magazine had a cover story that you'll probably recall in 1996, where it said the future is push.
Oh yeah, I think
I do.
That? Yeah, that's right.
And there was a company kind of in the South Bay that I traveled down to for a meeting once, and it was, oh my God, the name was something Cast. Do you remember this place? And I think it was a TV company. And it was about, oh, you know what it was? There was this application, and it was something cast. And you open up the application, and all the content gets pushed to you.
Oh, right. Was it like an After Dark kind of thing or something like that?
Yeah, a little bit like that. Yeah. And so that was the cover story back then. It's funny how this idea of push changes and morphs over time. Like, what does push mean? So now it's come into this notification space. And I just wonder if, when do notifications start feeling as unmanageable and as crazy as email already does for people? So, like, it solves this problem for a certain class of people, then 2 years later down the road, it actually becomes a problem in itself that needs to be solved again.
Yeah, yeah, the noise, just the noise level.
So have you checked out Yo?
No, I've heard about it, but I've not checked it out. So I don't know much about it. I just know it's big.
Well, it's big and stupid, depending on who you ask, but it also could be big and really smart in its simplicity, where it's not actually an app that's about saying yo to someone, you know, which is what it does. It's, if I send it to you, it says yo from me. If you, you know, that's all
it
does.
Can you add anything to that yo, or is that it?
That's it. But if you partner it with if this then that, or I'm sure other services that will be coming along, you could send a yo message to your garage door to open up if your garage door is linked to a Wi-Fi capable electrical system. So you could use yo as a trigger to turn things on or off that are connected to the internet, and then it's like, oh, okay, this silly app that's received a lot of notice and VC money could potentially become useful. So where notifications or smaller messages that are even smaller than an SMS suddenly have great power, it's kind of...
Yeah, it doesn't have to be content, does it? It can actually, as you say, be triggers. It can do stuff.
It's like an on or off switch.
But where do you manage all that? I mean, like, I find just managing if this then that and all the social network alerts and all the different levels of email from priority to low priority. I mean, I really have to do housekeeping all the time. And I find I'm switching task managers all the time because some of them do some things well and some don't do others, or some don't integrate with Evernote because I got to have that integration for this and that. And it's, yeah, I can see it spiraling out of control pretty soon.
There's no simple solution for all of this. I know that with your startup, you are tasked with looking at that kind of bleeding edge and evaluating all these systems and services and figuring out which one is going to kind of break out ahead, right? Because you got to be
or less. Yeah, we get asked that wonderful question every now and again. Where's it all leading? I never have an answer for that.
The thing that I keep trying to ask myself, and I ask other people who have questions about technology, is like, what do you want to do? Like, is there something in your daily life where you're like, oh, I wish I could, instead of writing this whole email, just type in 4 characters and have the preformed email come out, and I just fill in the name and change a couple of things, or, you know, like. And people don't think about their computers this way. Like, you and I are different in that way. We see them as these machines and tools that can lessen the time that we spend with them if we're using them in a kind of power user way. But most people don't. They just kind of take it, oh, this is this thing. And they don't think about what could potentially solve their time spent looking at that screen or lessen their time. And that's my thing, is to incorporate new apps, systems, backups, scripts, Hazel rules, whatever, that just allow me to do less.
Does the time it takes to craft those rules and things, do you find it still saves time in the end if you were to add up all the kind of the creation time? Because I wonder, and even I say with this smartwatch that I'm not looking at a screen, empirically away from a screen more often, but in effect I'm tethered still in a way. So I don't know if that's a true statement, you know?
Yeah, I understand that too. It's like the more the more married you are to the solution, the longer you're going to be together.
Yeah, yeah.
But for a lot of the projects that I work on, especially with the 15%, something as simple as text expander has just saved our lives.
Right. Replies and
just dealing with the voluminous communication that needs to be responded to promptly, efficiently, and professionally and clearly. Text expander is just huge. And then as a photographer or anyone who's creating tons of digital assets all the time, with pictures especially, these rules with Hazel for renaming and then putting them into a folder structure, and then they automatically import into Lightroom without me thinking or managing. Everything is dialed in. And of course, these are Mac solutions, and a lot of the stuff I get from that Mac users. What is it called?
Power users. Yeah, I used to listen to that all the time. And in fact, they got me into Alfred, which I really like, because that one is, I can understand that. Hazel, it's too far for me. That's a bridge too far.
And Alfred, Alfred's great. I don't use it. I use this controller called Launch Center. And just having just something like that. Imagine, okay, every time, let's say I want to launch Chrome, I hit F12 and the letter C and then return. And I can do that in a millisecond without reaching for, I can do that in the time it would take to reach for the mouse to go find it in my applications menu and launch it. Most people use their computers in that really kind of basic rote way. I want to launch an application. Let's go to my applications folder. And being able to do anything with keystrokes is just...
keystrokes is a very Mac thing, isn't it? And I don't want to turn this into a Mac versus Windows thing, but Windows people, do they, and I say this because I don't know, do they do keystrokes and shortcuts on the keyboard?
Not that I know of, not that I've ever seen. I'm sure more advanced users do. I haven't met them nor talked to them ever about how they get their work done. But I just I don't know what I'd do without these things. You know, it's like it makes it so that I can do so much more work in less time, quite honestly. Yeah. So this watch new, it's a new segment. So here's the question, I guess, like, it's being developed. Hardware manufacturers, software manufacturers are meeting in this segment to create it. Is it necessary?
Yeah, that's a good question, because a lot of people with wearables, you know, everybody's telling us it's the next big thing and it's going to be huge, and you're going to have wearable computers all over your body doing different things. And I think a lot of people are asking the question, what do I need it for? Do I need it? But you're right, there seems to be this momentum that is barreling forward that no one can stop, towards things like smartwatches and Google Glass type headgear. And you know, there's all these breakthroughs, supposed breakthroughs around battery technology that will be almost like a cloth, so it can fit into your clothing and stuff. And yeah, it is solutions for things that I don't think they found all the problems for yet. So I don't know.
So Kevin Kelly, back again to Wired, he's this kind of techno-futurist who may have been, he was probably the first managing editor at Wired and provided a lot of the early editorials back in the 90s where, you know, talking about the networked world and how your refrigerator would be eventually connected to the internet, and people thought he was crazy, and Nicholas Negroponte, these people were, you know, laughed at, and all the stuff is coming true. So last week he wrote something new on Medium that I actually like. It really opened my eyes and made me think in a new way about what's happening right now. And he essentially said, there is no time better than 2014 to be creating a new startup and making these new technologies and creating something new, essentially. Like 20, 30 years from now, he's going to say, oh my God, 2014, 15, that was just a great time to be doing these things. And that will achieve a state 20 years from now. Like right now, let's say an iPhone has, let's just say maybe four kind of capable sensors. There's like a gyroscope sensor, there's like an iBeacon thing. There's something that measures your footsteps. I don't know what else is in there, but let's say it's less than 5 sensors, that 20 years from now, these things will have 100 sensors inside of them and be able to do a myriad of things that no one can even imagine at this point, but that now is the greatest time to be doing these things. How do you feel about that?
I hope that's the case. I can say kind of trying to start a company around all that stuff. Yeah, I hope that's the case. But I do worry that, do you think everybody, each generation says that though, I suppose. I mean, it's going to be interesting if the next generation would have said, you know, how archaic some of our stuff actually was in a way.
People might have said during the OPEC oil crisis in the late 70s that there is no better time to create a solar technology company and, creating solar cells for the solar revolution. And that went nowhere because Reagan was elected and solar just, you know, kind of alternative energies were sat on for 35 years. There's so much more in play than just time, but maybe it really feels now that with the kind of penetration of, did I just say that? I can't say
that. You did say the penetration. we really need the jargon bingo or something.
All right, here we go.
Some money with that one.
The penetration of smartphones in people's pockets. That's penetrating.
Oh, it is. That's a person.
With the ubiquity of these technologies actually on people's bodies, that there is this kind of inevitability in this weird, this strong momentum that's pushing this whole thing forward and feels kind of unstoppable. And that's how I see this watch thing, that the watch thing is developed because everybody said it would, not necessarily because it's needed and everybody wants it. I think we're not, as a society, as humans, I don't think we're ready for super capable wearable technology. I don't know when we will be, but it's going to be created for us. It'll be interesting to see if there's a backlash or if, like, somehow that advancement gets lessened because people aren't ready for it. I wonder where it's heading.
Well, you know, it reminds me of that rule, the Star Trek rule for technological innovation, which is that if you didn't see something very similar on a Star Trek episode or film, then it's not necessary. So you see in a lot of the Star Trek, and embarrassingly, I've seen a couple of them recently, like Next Generation and those kind of things. They've got little pads, you know, so that's the iPad. They've got communicators, which are like the smartphones. Nobody's talking into a watch in Star Trek. That hasn't happened at all. And so people are really, I mean, obviously it's absurd, but people are really married to that, you know, to bring these products out, some of the best minds in science fiction couldn't even envision a reason for it. So there's no reason for it, kind of thing. Yeah, I'm not sure what to think about that, but I thought I'd say that anyway.
No, that's great. I think we're only limited by the best minds in science fiction. I think that's a barrier, actually, that what people are doing in the real world with real things and real lives has always been so much more fascinating and interesting to me. I'm an anti-fantasy, anti-sci-fi person.
Yeah, I can't get into that stuff. I do watch Star Trek every now and again, I will admit that. But
are the communicators like handheld? Are they about the size of a phone?
Yeah, well, they've changed. So back in the original William Shatner days, they were pretty big, and he'd have to kind of dramatically flip it open. It was kind of like a flip phone, kind of like a Motorola Razr type of thing. And then over the years, the communicators have gotten small enough that they wear them on their chest and just kind of tap their chest. And that is supposed to hearken a certain type of wearable device communicator that we will have, but they certainly never tapped a watch on their wrist or anything like that.
Did the emblem on their
clothes right. It was the emblem.
Speak to it?
Exactly. The emblem was the communicator. At least in, I think, Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and that kind of stuff.
I mean, these phones aren't necessarily wearables, but if I go for a run, I take my phone with me. I run with it in my hand because I don't have something to really secure it to my body in the way that would feel ergonomic while running. And I have that Strava app up and it charts my run and the distance and how many steps I took and how fast I did it and all that. I mean, we're kind of already doing it.
Yeah. The app I want to try out, I don't go for runs, so I can't really try it out. But there's one called Zombies Run, which is, it tells you a story and you listen to it as you run, that zombies are coming and you've got to accelerate or cut quickly to the right. I mean, I don't know how it can effectively, you know, move the directions you're running and that kind of thing, but it's supposed to be fantastic. And you get so into it that you don't think about running. You think about these invisible zombies chasing you.
I love that, especially here in Atlanta where they film Walking Dead, or at least parts of it. We're a zombie heavy town here. Everybody's in love with
the whole...
I didn't realize that.
Right.
Yeah, that's Atlanta and the outskirts. But you know what's funny is, like, I don't know if I've been indoctrinated into this from my wife, but it's like just the idea of zombies, I'm like, come on. Like, when, yes. Okay, so my first... I was awakened to zombies as a kid in the 70s when the first zombie movies, like the invention of the zombie, I think zombies were kind of a 70s invention.
Night of the Living Dead, right? Wasn't that what started it?
Yeah, right. And they're slow moving and they walk with their arms out and then they occasionally eat people.
Brains,
right? And then they danced in a Michael Jackson video at some point.
Yeah, that's right. It did a leap to the music video.
But I wonder what happens when you first encounter zombies. And like, so somebody encountered it in the exact same way I did and was just like, awesome. I love that. I totally love zombies. Like zombies who move slow and eat human brains. I love that. I want to have zombies in my life.
It's so huge now. It's unbelievable. So you know, I live in Northamptonshire, so it's kind of in the middle of England. And there's a tiny town near us called Stony Stratford. And they are known throughout the UK for having a zombie pub crawl once a year, where everybody dresses up as zombies and moves between the various pubs in Stony Stratford. And it's apparently huge. I talk to people, you know, in London, and they're like, so you live near that Stony Stratford place? I'm like, yeah, the zombies, I know. It's huge. I don't understand how people get into it.
So I wish you could experience, at least see the cognitive dissonance that I get to see in my wife when she sees a clip that has zombies in it, but not just the kind of zombies as an idea, but this thing that happened with zombies maybe 4 or 5 years ago where they started moving really fast.
Yeah, they got really good, didn't they?
Like this, zombies don't work. That as an idea doesn't work. Fast moving zombies?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, a decaying body somehow getting super strength. It's kind of, yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
So, I mean, there were people, though, when they first encountered a zombie, were like, this is the coolest thing ever. I want to dress up as a zombie. I want to fly cross country and go to Comic-Con and hang out with other dressed up zombies in San Diego for a week. Or,
is there
no,
a zombie
even,
culture? Like there's the Klingon
zombies
language?
Are huge, or, yes.
Right. So do you speak zombie to other people when you're out, you know, in an evening and you're both dressed as a zombie?
Why are people so scared of something moving so slow?
But are zombies the new vampires? Because I feel like vampires were so big for so long. All those terrible vampire shows and teeny bopper vampire films and
yeah, vampires,
all that crap.
Vampires became really big when vampires became hot.
Yeah, exactly. Buffy the Vampire Slayer. From there, when it became an attractive, sexual... And nobody wanted to mention that because it was on primetime television, but there was a sexual component to the vampire thing that was somehow allowed.
The great thing, whoever figured that out, is that there was always a sexual component to to a guy with fang teeth saying, I want to suck your blood, yeah, and, you know, biting your neck. Like, okay, you know, call it what you will, but you could say vaguely sexual in that. And that somebody said, ah, I want to take this vaguely sexual thing about vampires and make it overtly sexual and never say that that's what's happening. And then you have a huge hit on your hands.
But there's nothing sexual about zombies, though. So they've taken the sexual part out. They have almost, they've, as you say, made them super powered and fast, and
here's
and people
what it
still
is.
Like it.
It's got to be this end of the world thing, right? Like, what do you call it when the end of the world is
apocalypse?
Nigh? Yeah, it's this apocalypse fantasy. This, and it could be an anti-technology thing that people are really revved up for now. It could be annihilation. It could be just our this decade's version of what we experienced in the late 80s with the day after and the whole kind of nuclear annihilation.
That the 50s and 60s with War of the Worlds that the Martians were going to attack? It
yeah.
is, yeah.
That every decade has its own way of getting scared about and loving the annihilation of the planet. Just now it's happening from these slow-moving, flesh-dropping zombies. It seems hilarious to me. Yeah.
Because it's never just one or two zombies. It's like the entire world, except for two or three people.
And if you get bitten, do you slowly become one of them, right?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you'll start craving brains. And that is one of the rules that seems to work across all of the films.
How long can a show about zombies go on? Eventually, everybody's going to become
a zombie.
Well,
that's what I was wondering with that Walking Dead thing. I mean, what are they on, season 4 or 5? There can't be any of them left. And really, what are the writers coming up with? Okay. This time they're going to go into a gas station and there's going to be a zombie inside. I mean, come on. It was done the first season. It's got to be.
I saw a picture and I think it's from Walking Dead. I can't watch the show. The only reason I would, or actually I think I've seen an episode and a half, and I'll watch things that I don't want to see or I think are really bad just in order to see the backgrounds and locations, because so much is taking place now in Georgia in terms of film taxation credits that so tons of Hollywood is coming here and is making movies and TV shows here. So I'll watch stuff just to see, hey, there's, you know, the Plaza Theater. Hey, there's the little diner next door. And yeah, there are tours now that you can come to as a tourist to Atlanta and hop on a bus and go see all these locations where The Walking Dead was filmed.
Really?
Yeah.
And is it like a bus that is made up with like, is it a decaying bus and then it's got a, it's got like really like
get,
bad.
You have to pay extra to get chased down the road by zombies. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So what else, man?
Man, zombies, crazy.
Hey, here's something a little bit about tech and kind of about this space that we're in with drafts here is when Overcast came out, you know, I tried it out and I was like, this is ridiculous. You can't stream a podcast through it. You have to download it. The space on my phone is super limited. You're on Android. This won't make any this.
I know. Yeah, and this was one of those things because I'm such a podcast fanatic and I really like Marco Arment and the podcasts he does, and you know, I'm still an iOS guy deep inside there somewhere, and Overcast was one thing that would probably bring me back. I'll wait and see what the next iPhone is going to look like, but I'm really bummed out I can't have that app. I really want it.
It's great. It does a really great job at what it does, and it's funny too because it taught me something where if, let's say, an app or a product comes at you and gives you something that you kind of weren't expecting, it can change your behavior in a way that's unpredictably positive. So I'm listening to fewer podcasts.
Why? Because you have to download it.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
I'm enjoying that more. And because the podcasts are downloaded, his app is able to do some of this kind of post-processing on the video, on the audio files themselves that isn't capable unless they're streaming. So some kind of sonic compression that allows them to sound better, so much so I can actually listen to them in my car playing through the phone without plugging it into a car stereo. So
really I think somebody gave me a demo of that. It's something that kind of increases the voice. It's kind of like hitting boom sound or something.
It's great.
Increases, yeah.
The weird thing, though, is that the problems that he's solved technologically aren't anything that seem to me that they're not anything that Apple couldn't do or just put into their own apps at some point. Like, what do they call that? The Sherlockification when you're creating a product
yeah,
or an app.
Sherlocked.
Yeah.
And then what does the app also do? It can speed up the podcast, not by increasing the speed of the voices, but by taking out the dead sound between talking, right?
Yeah, it smartly removes silence. And it also speeds it up, too. It's not normal speed. It definitely feels faster, and people's voices are, you know, they can be a little hard to figure out. I find that if I listen to anything sped up, it actually speeds me up and makes me more kind of anxious and nervous. It's not a total time saver. It has a cost. It has a little psychological cost. It'll take 10 or 20 fewer minutes to listen to it, but you might be a little more amped up in a way you might not want to be.
Well, I have always felt that podcasts that have people in conversation are almost relaxing in a way, because conversation at its particular speed, you know, it kind of necessitates sitting back and, you know, kind of being a part of it. Whereas you're right, if you speed it up, it's more of a delivery type of thing. It's more of an action.
Yeah, it's like a give me this data stream as quickly as possible so I can filter out what's important to me. And that's fine, you know. It's funny to have gone through that, though, to be like, oh, I want to listen to all this stuff faster, and then to realize, there's a cost associated with that. I become kind of part. Here's the thing with all of this is that I believe some of this mobile technology and really any kind of new technology now is resulting in being, it is turning people into machines a little bit. So I feel that that our own human gestures become very machine-like, whether it's like, oh, look at my watch. Oh, look at my watch. Oh, look at my watch. Oh, bring this phone out of the pocket. I might have told you this story, but this guy I know in town who's a really big Instagrammer, great guy, good photographer, said that when he's in a bar, he can tell who's on Instagram without looking at their phone because he can just see the style of gesture that they're employing to scroll through those photos. And that's a gesture that he doesn't think he sees. You can't read that fast. You're not scrolling through text that fast. And then he can see the double tap of a like on a particular picture. But that kind of thing, it's like, that's a repetitive motion that millions of, you know, thousands of people are having at the exact same time. Where the more we become, the more we use these machines and use them in these ideal ways, the more that we kind of become them. Like, we are speaking a language for them. It's not necessarily our own language. And it's all metaphor too, right? That double tap isn't just a double tap of a thumb. It's a transaction of telling someone, hey, I like this, and they'll receive that like. And I don't know, all of it. Yeah. I have to really be careful, and I have to be careful for myself and for the people around me too, to just, as much as I love all this, there is a cost associated with it. And I just have to be cognizant of that and try to remain healthy.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And on your last point, I think it's what worries me as well, which I kind of spoke about before, is I don't want to, I guess it's the fear of regret. I don't want to look back in 10, 20 years when my daughter's grown up and think, geez, during those special times, I was staring at my phone all the time. So yeah, I catch myself worrying a lot about that.
Yeah, we've had a couple of weeks here at the house that have been fairly stressful and busy and fast moving. And the other day we had a kind of chance to step back and unplug a little bit. And we were talking and it was like, I just said, yeah, I know I've been bad with that lately. Like, you know, maybe you're not giving the fullest attention that you can give, and yet you're still choosing not to give it That's a problem. You feel like you're getting away with it. So, like, just to put all my cards on the table, if, let's say, I'm waking up in the morning and I'm there and she's, our daughter's in her crib, she's waking up, I might have my phone with me, but have it hidden by my leg so she doesn't see me using it. But she knows I'm she's smart, man. She knows I'm using it. She knows I'm looking down at my leg and the environs of my leg. She sees that there's this slight glow coming from that area. She's, you know, people aren't dumb. And, like, it's like we've got to be careful. And so even when I'm doing it, know I'm doing it, know it's not the best thing to be doing and choose to still be doing it, that's a bit of a problem. So
you're not alone with that.
That what I described was probably minor transgression, but I guess the first step is just to realize what you're doing and move from there, make decisions from there. I don't think a lot of people realize what they're doing.
Yes, or a lot of people feel, you know, what the heck, I deserve my personal time, and it takes the guise of you know, multitasking with, you know, other important parts of my life, and hey, I can multitask effectively, and everybody wins, kind of. But you're right, they don't realize what they're losing.
I haven't been in a major metropolitan city in a while. I think maybe the last one was New York a few months ago. I don't think Atlanta is a major metropolitan city. I think it's a country city, and the behavior in it is according to that. But
that's interesting. We'll have to explore that concept at some point.
I think that, I mean, it's just got to be crazy to be on public transportation in New York or London and just see how people are using technology. I mean, it's got to be up to like 65% of people are looking at their palms, right?
Well, I actually remember when I came out to London was in 2000, and I remember it was kind of weird at the time in 2000 for people to be looking at their phones. You'd be a little self-conscious about even pulling a phone out on the tube or on a train. And then I remember getting my iPhone and realizing that I was staring at my phone a lot more than the typical phone, and I was really self-conscious about that. And then I remember getting an iPad and pulling that out for the first time on the tube. Now you see iPads everywhere on the tube. Nobody's nervous about pulling them out. Nobody's got any issues. Nobody's self-conscious. People have laptops just propped up on their laps and working. And then I suppose the more modern thing is, and thank God I don't do it, but I considered taking a Google Glass onto a onto a tube train, and thank God I didn't do it. But it'd be the same type of thing. I've seen somebody with Google Glass on the tube. I've seen people with the smartwatches, and I'm one of them, but I make sure that my cuff is down over my watch and I don't use it on the train.
It's all such a slippery slope that gets us to this new present in which we've said to ourselves, hey, this is acceptable behavior. What's next? Like, give me my next thing, and we'll make allowances for that. That's fascinating. It just all keeps trending toward this human machine interface, which who knows what the heck that's going to look like.
And the machine is becoming more and more invisible, I suppose. So whether that's a good thing, so that people aren't seeing you connected, when in reality you're actually more connected than when you had a physical device that was present, it's interesting. So as they're getting smaller and disappearing and turning into wearables and being sewn into your clothing and embedded in your brain and that kind of stuff, it's sure you're losing the physical external, but it's you're a lot more connected. It's really interesting. Yes. So I tell you, I'm going to an arcade festival this weekend. Very analog stuff. There's only a few wires run those things.
Oh, that's so great. Yesterday I had my best nine holes ever. I shot a 33 for nine holes at dusk yesterday, which would be a 66, which would be
a good
round of golf. That's
crazy. That's like video game numbers there, Michael. That's great.
And yesterday, to that point, I was thinking about video games, and then I was thinking about golf, and I was like, oh, that's what I do. Like, if somebody asked me, hey, you play video games, you play games, what game you play? I'd just be like, I play golf. Like, it is such a video game in writ real. It's more of a video game than like playing basketball or baseball, or like, it is so technical and scientific. And so, case in point, yesterday I hit this incredible shot and this friend of mine said, "That's your best swing of the day," regardless of where the ball went. And the ball was perfect. It was right. It was a perfect shot. But it was the perfect golf swing, and I felt like a machine.
Right.
So, like, back to this weird digitalification of things. And, like, I could go long on this, and I'm not going to. Just the difference between the words golf swing and what people think that is versus, like, what actually makes a really good golf swing and what that feels like. And the two things are, like, completely different languages. That a great golf swing actually feels extremely, like, it can feel like really controlled and not even really a swing. It's just like a move through the ball rather than swinging a piece of metal at this thing on the ground. But yeah, so that was great.
It's interesting because I would have thought it would have felt more organic, more natural, more going with the flow of your natural body's, I don't know, gravity and movement and all that.
The more I play, the more I'm convinced there's absolutely nothing natural about a good golf swing. There's nothing natural about it, man. It's the weirdest, most unnatural motion ever. And the steps to becoming good are to make this total unnatural feeling feel as natural as possible.
Wow. That's something to
through
to
repetition,
contemplate.
You know, through focus, and like you do it again and again, and everything's always changing. But the video game-ness of it is starting to become very real to me, like the numbers and the wind and the slope and the stance and the club and the pressure and it's incredible amount of calculation that passes through your mind in split seconds.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
That's stupid golf stuff, but we'll talk about
cool.
that some other time. But yeah,
I
was
good.
I had three birdies in nine holes and I bogeyed one, so it was a 33. So that was great kind of weekend achievement.
That's great, dude. I got to Mission 4 of Metal Slug a few days ago. I was very excited about that.
What's Metal Slug? I've never heard of it.
Metal Slug is what is under the genre run and gun. So you scroll to the right, you run and shoot everything you can and keep going to the right and keep going and keep going. And it's a game that came out in the mid-90s for the Neo Geo system.
Nice.
So yeah.
So the
you get to kill a lot of stuff.
The Neo Geo plugs into what? How are you playing this again?
So the Neo Geo is a stand-up, in my case, it is a stand-up arcade cabinet that's got what's called a four-slot MVS system, so I can put four games in at a time. And that's back when arcade managers needed to save space, right? So that you could put multiple games in one machine, and this is one of those games. So yes, I hope to play some Neo Geo this coming weekend. We'll see.
Have a great time at this vintage arcade fest. It's going to be awesome. You're going to love it.
I know. It's a shame you're not there to take pictures, because I imagine there will be some photo-worthy human beings walking around this show.
So. I'm sure. There will be a few pocket protectors, I hope.
I expect. Yes, I expect.
Well, enjoy it.
I have a few myself. Thank you, my friend. Take care. Well, have a good
More
week.
Later.
And more soon.